In the book of Nehemiah, we have just completed some readings in the book of Ezra, and we move on almost necessarily to the book of Nehemiah, because they belong together as to time. And this evening, for the benefit of those who have not been with us during the Ezra readings, may I give you just a little potted history before I read Nehemiah chapter 1. If you have a bit of paper and a pencil, I would give you 7 dates. If you don't note them down and can't remember them, well, that may not matter so much, but I'll give you them at any rate. Here they are, first of all, just the dates. B.C., before Christ, 597, 586, 536, 520, 516, 458, 445. 597, the first deportation of Jews from Jerusalem to Babylon, when the Jews and Israel had sinned so much that God sent them away to Babylon in captivity for 70 years, so that their systems might be rid of idolatry. And it is a fact that after 70 years, the remnant that returned, and Orthodox Jews to this very day, have an abhorrence of idolatry, that the Jews of the monarchy, all the hundreds of years of the monarchy, never had. First deportation in 597, the final deportation, when Jerusalem was sacked and burned to the ground, including the temple, 586. The first return for 70 is a round number. The first return under the grandson of the second last king of the Jews, Zerubbabel, along with Joshua the high priest, took place in 536. 537, 536. And almost at once they set up an altar in the open air amongst the ruins of the temple and worshipped God in the open air. But because of the opposition of those around them, they weren't permitted to build for 16 years. Yes, they built their own houses, as Haggai will tell you, but they weren't allowed to build a temple. Their enemies wouldn't allow them to build the temple for 16 years, until Haggai the prophet and Zechariah the prophet arose and said, "Here, it's all very well for you to build your own houses, but what about the Lord's house? That's the center of our life and worship." And so they began to rebuild in 520. The temple was completed, such as it was, not with the glory, of course, of Solomon's temple, but it was completed in 516 B.C., 4 years, roundly. Now, from 516 to 458, we have practically, dates, of course, can be difficult in the Old Testament, we have practically 60 years during which we know nothing about what was happening in Jerusalem at all. Sometime after 486, there's the story of Esther, you remember. But that was in Persia. Not even mentioning the name of God, and certainly not the name of Jerusalem. So Esther, the book of Esther, doesn't help us at all to know what was going on in Jerusalem. But evil things were going on in Jerusalem. They were beginning to marry foreign pagan women. And of course, it was marriages with the heathen, the adultery that was involved, that led to idolatry. These two always go together, whichever is the former. Adultery and idolatry. And so 4:5-8, the Lord sent Ezra, and the king of Persia sent Ezra to Jerusalem to deal with the people. And he was absolutely shocked at what he found. That takes us round about to the time of Malachi, the very last prophecy in the Old Testament. And if you were to read the second chapter and the first 10 verses, you would see what Malachi says about marrying heathen women. And Ezra demanded that these marriages should be broken, and the wives and the children of them put aside. Then, not many years after that, 4:5-8, 4:4-5, the Lord put it into Nehemiah, who heard that the enemies, after Ezra, the enemies of Israel were breaking down their wall and burning the gates. And he appealed to his sovereign Artaxerxes the Long-Handed, and he sent him back to Jerusalem. 4:4-5, 4:4-4. And that's what we're going to read about now in Nehemiah chapter 1. It is 17 years since I preached on Nehemiah, and 34 years since I wrote notes on the book. So, although we have made a number of forward references to Nehemiah recently in these studies following the exile's return to Jerusalem, it is time to look at the book itself, which contains one of the most memorable stories in the Old Testament. The first 7 chapters of the book of Nehemiah are written by the man himself, the action starting about 13 years after Ezra had set out for Jerusalem. Most of the action is crowded into the spring and summer of 4:4-5 BC, and that was during the long reign of Artaxerxes the Long-Handed, who had sent Ezra back to Jerusalem. Both acts of Artaxerxes, sending Ezra and then sending Nehemiah back to Jerusalem, were beneficent to the Jews. But in between these two actions, as we read in the long parenthesis in Ezra chapter 4, from verse 7 to 23, there we learn that the Trans-Euphrates enemies of the Jews, those on the western side of the Euphrates River, right down to Jerusalem, to Samaria at least, these enemies of the Jews sent a letter to Artaxerxes, complaining that these pestiferous Jews were rebuilding what they called the wicked city of Jerusalem, and were restoring its walls and its foundations. Ezra 4:12. And they were doing so with the intention of rebelling against the king and refusing to pay any more taxes. 4:13. So these enemies of the Jews now obsequiously appeal to the king to put a stop to the rebuilding, which he did, until, he says, it pleased him to give a contrary order. Ezra 4:21. Now the dear scholar Derek Kidner thinks the letter was written years after Ezra had arrived in Jerusalem, and after Ezra's reforms, when he bid the Jewish men put away the heathen wives, was written years after Ezra had arrived in Jerusalem, and after his reforms were well advanced, and therefore not long before this present action of Nehemiah's that we read of in the first chapter took place, which makes Nehemiah's action all the more daring, since he obviously intends to do nothing less than to appeal to the king to let him return to Jerusalem to rebuild the walls, since the enemies of the Jews had not only complained to the king about the rebuilding of their walls, but they had actually done damage to the walls and the gates of the city. Nehemiah 1:3. Now, some have thought when they read Nehemiah chapter 1 and verses 1 to 3, especially 3, some have thought that Nehemiah was lamenting the original destruction of Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar when the Jews were taken away to Babylon. But of course, that's nonsense. That took place something like 140 years earlier, as 2 Chronicles 36 and 19 would tell you. This third verse of our chapter could hardly refer to that. But the letter of complaint in Ezra chapter 4, verses 7 to 23, was just one example. We'll see plenty more of that kind of thing in Nehemiah. Was just one example of attempt by Israel's enemies, all inspired by the chief enemy, Satan. They were all attempts by Israel's enemies to prevent, now notice this carefully, this is very important, to prevent the survival of the Jewish remnant until the predicted coming of Messiah, their king. The devil wanted to destroy Israel so that Christ should never come. As simple as that. That's the story of the Old Testament. That's it in a nutshell. That's it in a sentence. More of that perhaps later on. We have already referred to what the enemies of the Jews in Susa had tried to do to exterminate the Jews throughout the Persian Empire in the reign of Esther's Ahasuerus, or Xerxes as is his proper name. That took place anything from 20 to 30 years before this. But of course, hostility to God's purpose of preparing a people by whom Christ should come, hostility to that is constant throughout the Old Testament. It is the theme par excellence in the Old Testament, linking the Old Testament with the New. Indeed, this theme of the enemies of Israel trying to destroy her, including Esau, Edom, this theme, I suggest to scholars who are here this evening, especially Old Testament scholars, this theme would provide an excellent thesis for an Old Testament scholar to trace the hostility of Israel's enemies throughout their long Old Testament career. I have tried to deal with this in the booklet Sweeping Through the Old Testament Scriptures, which I hope you'll find in the bookstall there, which I think needs to be more widely read and understood and accepted. Because that booklet began as a series in the Congregational Record and went on for a year or two. Now, such a theme as that, the hostility of Israel's enemies, such a theme as that of satanic hostility to Israel throughout the Old Testament, in my view, is a much more valuable subject for research than some of the abstruse obscurities suggested by those who are perhaps more preoccupied with technicalities, Old Testament and Hebrew technicalities, than with the broad, sweeping message of the Old Testament in its preparation for the New Testament and for the coming of Christ. All right then, the account of Nehemiah's distress when he heard how the Jews, enemies had attacked them and had demolished their rebuilt walls and burned their gates with fire. That story is as well known as perhaps any part of the Old Testament, or next to the stories of the patriarchs in Genesis. How the alarm was sounded in Susa, or Shushan, in the south of the country, which anciently was Elam, now Iran. And Shushan, or Susa, is not very far from Iraq's Basra, that we've heard so much about lately. It was there that the Persian kings repaired to in the winter, to their winter palace. Now, Nehemiah's brother Hanani had come with others from Jerusalem, and that was a long way, something like 1,000 miles. And Nehemiah, questioning Hanani concerning the exiles in Jerusalem, since Hanani doubtless knew of Ezra's expedition 13 years before to reestablish the law, Nehemiah discovered through what he learned from Hanani the bad news that the walls of the city had been broken down and its gates destroyed by fire. And it shocked him to the core. Now, we remember that Ezra had gone to Jerusalem with great expectations of reestablishing the law and the life of the people. They had been there 60 years and had fallen away from the truth. But Ezra was so dismayed at what he found there that it drove him into paroxysms of grief, such as we saw in Ezra chapters 9 and 10. But he certainly, when he arrived in Jerusalem and came to himself, he certainly made a mighty impact upon those exiles. By his very grief, he made an impact upon them, to the extent that he caused these sinners actually to break up their ungodly marriages. An astonishing thing, with only 2 dissenting voices, which were, of course, ignored. But considering all that Ezra subsequently did to purge the people of their foreign, adulterous involvements with these heathen women, which involvements would undoubtedly have led the Jews back again to idolatry if they had continued. I say, considering all that Ezra subsequently did to purge the people of this adulterous involvement, it may not be so surprising that the external enemies of the Jews should have wanted to have a go at the exiles, as we read of in Ezra 4:7-23. For, you see, they would have been mad, the enemies of Israel would have been mad at the racial separation where the marriages were broken, and putting away these foreign wives and children, which to do may have affected some of these hostile characters very personally indeed. They were furious. So, following this spiteful demolition of the walls and the burning of the gates, all work stopped by the king's decree, and would remain so until he gave contrary orders. So you see, everything was against Nehemiah doing anything about the bad news he had received from Jerusalem. What could he do? But, you know, little would the king have thought that while he was busy signing the letter to stop the work, his cupbearer was busy planning the opposite, namely how to appeal to the king that the rebuilding of the demolished walls, so wantonly broken down, would be restarted, and restarted by him, Nehemiah, the cupbearer to the king in Shushan. Little would the king have dreamt that that was going on, but it was. And you see, it all took place because the news Nehemiah heard was so intolerable to him that he simply had to find some way of reversing this decision of the king's. And we see from verse 4 of our chapter not only how deeply the news affected Nehemiah, but we also see what he determined to do. It drove him to prayer, as every such situation should do. It drove him to prayer. And the remainder of our chapter is therefore taken up with his prayer to the Lord. But you see, it's only at the end that he reveals that he was the king's cupbearer, tasting the king's wine, lest he be poisoned. And that, as Nehemiah calls him at the end of the first chapter, this man of whom he spoke in prayer, verse 11, was Artaxerxes himself. He was going to challenge the king. Now, whether the reference to the king as this man and Nehemiah's position vis-a-vis the king was intended to convey to us when we read the chapter what a difficult position Nehemiah was in, or whether he meant to convey by what he wrote that he was in an advantageous position, you see, being cupbearer to the king, in order to do something about the Jerusalem and the walls, who shall say? But there is no doubt that by the end of that prayer, Nehemiah was intent upon action, if the Lord would help him. Action to appeal directly to the king, to let him go to Jerusalem and do something about the dreadful news he had just heard. And the basis of Nehemiah's decision, you see, was the historical sweep of his prayer, which proved the turning point of it. So let's look at his prayer. It begins, as all good prayers should, theologically, with some reference to the God he is addressing and the nature of the God he is addressing. Some people who would like to take part in prayer say that they don't know what to say or how to start. Well, all the best prayers, especially in the Bible, begin with the prayers telling God how wonderful he is. That's a good start. It's the best start. In a sense, it's the only start. I think you know that unless we are rushing into the Lord's presence hurriedly on some urgent business, for the Lord is very patient and kind, we should take time to remember who we are talking to. Sometimes listening to services on the radio, which of course have to be prepared for timing and all that sort of thing. And you imagine a man reading from a paper, and he's right into the Lord's presence and out of it again in a moment or two. That's not prayer. We must remember who we're coming to. And that takes at least a moment or two. Now, notice, this does not necessarily apply to every intercessory prayer. Surely acknowledge, however briefly, who it is we are speaking to. And although the news from Jerusalem was so shocking that Nehemiah might have been excused rushing into the Lord's presence and pouring out his tale of woe in a torrent of lamentation, he nevertheless came before the Lord in a spirit of awe and addressed him as the great and awesome or terrible God. That, I think, should almost always be our approach in prayer. For you know, even as a matter of policy, it is wise to approach any authority from whom we seek a favor humbly and respectfully, if not deferentially. There's more to it than that here. The great and terrible God that Nehemiah addresses, who in his being is so awesome as to make the greatest saints tremble in his presence, is also a gracious and loving, covenant-making and covenant-keeping God. If he is a God we fear with reverential fear, he is also the God we have learned by his grace to love. And so the love and the fear should mingle together as they do beautifully in a devout prayer. However, I feel it is almost impossible for people out outside the charmed circle of Christ to understand this. So they separate the fear and the love. They separate the fear and the love so far from each other that they practically postulate two gods. And of course, vastly prefer the one to the other. And thus, in their lives, these outsiders, in their lives and in their thought, their God is schizophrenic, to the point of being two, the good God and the bad one. Which, if they hold to that duality, if they hold to that dichotomy, that split, long enough, they themselves will eventually split their own personalities. And they won't be able to make up their mind which is the greater God, the good one or the bad one. And they will often be tempted, when they look out in the world, to think that the bad one is the greater. It therefore behoves us who seek God's favor not only to be politically wise, but thankfully and even affectionately reverent in our approach to Him. But you see, this same spirit is immediately seen in the abjectness of Nehemiah's plea to the Lord to bend his ear and direct his eye to this anguished soul anxiously seeking his help. But, he must first confess his sin along with the sins of all Israel, past and present. He's confessing the total sin of Israel. Now, this is a great thing, that these godly men, for all their abhorrence of the sins of their race, will not dissociate themselves from the people in their sins, but confess as Jeremiah and others did, as if they were the veriest sinners themselves. They associate, they identify themselves with the sins of Israel. And that's exactly what Jesus did. He came and identified himself with us as sinners. And if you read Isaiah 53, you will see that when he was accused, he shut his mouth, because he accepted the accusation that he was this, follow this closely now, and don't misunderstand it, the sinless one was the sinner. That's fearful, isn't it? Frightening. Yeah, that's true. And that's why these godly men confess their sins along with their people. Because that's what Jesus did. And died, the sinless one died as the sinner, bearing the punishment of all the sins of his people. Some people can't stand this. And in their embarrassment, they tend to regard all such confession as pietistic, as for effect, and merely religious. But
There's nothing like that about Nehemiah. He's not saying these things for effect. Do you think that? No. His heart is riven with grief for his people. For he sees that almost every adversity that this tortured people, Israel, have suffered, has been their own fault for their sins, the enormity of which have cried to high heaven like mountains of provocation, until God has come down in condign judgment and decimated them. Why did 6 million Jews die under the hand of Hitler? Because God was against them. It was part of their punishment for crucifying Jesus. And all their troubles today and tomorrow, they won't end until they repent, as I was saying this morning. All of them is punishment. You remember what they said? His blood be on us and on our children. They should have shut up there and not mentioned the children. His blood be on us and on our children. Oh God! Unto umpteen generations, 1991 and beyond. Yes. Nehemiah knew something about that. Yes, he said, they are verily guilty. They have not only acted wickedly, but they have done so because they flouted God's commands, spurned his decrees and laws, which he gave to them through Moses. Now, look at the instruction that faithful man Moses brought down from the mount and applied to Israel's primitive condition in the wilderness in order to build them up as a disciplined people. And if you read the book of Exodus, it's thrilling to see that instead of Israel moving on towards Canaan from Sinai, my dear cousin who used to worship with us here more than 40 years ago was writing from Mount Sinai, climbing Mount Sinai, and saying what a wonderful experience it was to be there and sitting down and reading Moses there. Instead of them moving on toward Canaan from Sinai, as the rabble they were when they fled from Egypt and Pharaoh, they left Sinai. Read it again in the midst of the book of Exodus. They left Sinai in good order, ranked according to their tribes, like an army at its best, about to be inspected by its sovereign. An amazing transformation at Sinai through the law, the transforming power of the law of God. To have seen that procession at its best, marching through the torrid desert, would have been something. Surely the Lord from his heavenly height, maybe from his reconnoitering heavenly helicopter, looking down upon them, must have viewed them with pride as they set out from Sinai, everyone in his place. When they were young and keen and orderly and sanctified. But that didn't last long, as we know, as Moses feared it wouldn't. You remember screed after screed of these warning passages in the book of Deuteronomy as to what would happen to Israel if they turned from their God to worship idols. Why? Deuteronomy 28, one of the longest chapters in the Old Testament, Deuteronomy 28 predicts every sin in the book that they are to commit. And Nehemiah is practically confessing Israel to have committed them all in his prayer. But happily, and this is the great turning point in Nehemiah's prayer, happily, and it shows the thoroughness of Nehemiah's understanding of the ways of his God, Nehemiah doesn't worship and serve half a God, but a whole God, a unified, integrated God. For you see, now see what I'm coming to. For Deuteronomy chapter 28 leads not only to Deuteronomy chapter 29, the one number usually follows the other, doesn't it? But the theme is the same, you see, warnings to Israel right through Deuteronomy chapter 29. Warnings which are just as dire as those in 28. And full of evil prognostications about Israel. But Deuteronomy 28 and 29 leads on, of course, to Deuteronomy 30, which is perhaps the most evangelical chapter in the whole of the Old Testament, along with Jeremiah 31, for another reason. Now, let's this evening read a bit of Deuteronomy chapter 30 and see, after those long, somber threats in Deuteronomy 28 and 29, we'd never read all that tonight, you see what Deuteronomy 30 really says. Are you ready? When all these blessings and curses I have said before you come upon you, and you take them to heart wherever the Lord your God disperses you among the nations, and when you and your children return to the Lord your God and obey him with all your heart and with all your soul, according to everything I command you today, then the Lord your God will restore your fortunes and have compassion on you and gather you again from all the nations where he scattered you. And you know that since 1948, Jews have converged on Palestine, Tel Aviv, Jerusalem, from practically every nation on the earth. And I was there, oh dear, in 1965, at Passover time. The hotel we were staying in Tel Aviv, Tom Swanson and I, was full of Jews with faces as black. And Jews they certainly were. And we know how many have come from Ethiopia since, all over the world, where he has scattered you. Verse 4 of chapter 30. Even if you have been banished to the most distant land under the heavens, from there the Lord your God will gather you and bring you back. We read that, didn't we, in Nehemiah tonight? He will bring you to the land that belongs to your fathers, and you will take possession of it. He will make you more prosperous and numerous than your fathers. The Lord your God will circumcise your hearts and the hearts of your descendants. You see, circumcision and baptism speak of the crucifixion of the sinful self. Circumcise your hearts and the hearts of your descendants, so that instead of loving self and sin and Satan and everything bad, you love God and Jesus, so that you may love him with all your heart and with all your soul, and live. The Lord your God, he goes on to say, will put all these curses on your enemies who hate and persecute you. Arabs, take care. You will again obey the Lord and follow all his commands I am giving you today. Then the Lord your God will make you most prosperous in all the work of your hands and in the fruit of your womb, the young of your livestock and the crops of your land. The Lord will again delight in you and make you prosperous, just as he delighted in your fathers, if you obey the Lord your God and keep his commands and decrees that are written in this book of the law, and turn to the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul. Oh, but Israel would say, reading that, we can never rise to that. That's too high for us. Is it? That's not what God says to Israel or to you or me. Read the next verse, 11 of Deuteronomy 30. Now, he says, I am commanding you today. What I am commanding you today is not too difficult for you or beyond your reach. Isn't that kind? Not too difficult for you or beyond your reach. It is not up in heaven, so that you have to ask, who will ascend into heaven to get it and proclaim it to us that we may obey it? Nor is it beyond the sea, so that you have to ask, who will cross the sea to get it and proclaim it to us so that we may obey it? No! The word is very near you. It is in your mouth and in your heart, so that you may obey it.